Today is the last day of this week. Next week we'll have Xiaogang Wen, who'll teach us about topological order. So today is the last day on tensor networks. And summarizing what we saw this week, we've discussed two tensor networks, matrix quadratic states, up here, the mirror in here, MPS mirror. And by now, when you see these drawings, you should have an idea of what they mean. Okay? So we started 2 weeks ago. We didn't know what that meant. But now probably we know what it means a little bit. And so what we saw then is that matrix product states, so these two ansatz are describing wave functions of one-dimensional systems. Okay? You look at the open legs here, and they correspond to sites on a one-dimensional lattice. And what we can see is that one ansatz, the matrix product state, spans one dimension. And the other ansatz, the mirror, spans an additional dimension, which is related to scale, length scale in the system, in the sense that this could define, if we cut here, we would find a Coase-Lane lattice. And if we would look at one side of this lattice, it corresponds to many, many sides of the original lattice. Okay, there is a sense of RG flow going in this direction. Okay. And what we saw in the last few days is that correlations in the matrix product state decay exponentially with the distance. And remember that this was just the result of the fact that this correlator could be computed as the product of L matrices. And then we were picking up the leading contribution as some eigenvalue to the Lth power. Okay? That explained why we had exponential decay of correlations in the MPS. Whereas in the mirror, when we try to compute an expectation value of an operator here and another operator there, we again had some metrics that was being multiplied, but we were going up in length scale and down again, and this path here is only log L. So we had to multiply some metrics log L times. Okay, and just from this, so we would pick up the leading eigenvalue to log L, and that amounts to polynomial decay of correlations. Yes?
I thought that at some point you didn't quite want to call this normalization pre-normalization. You said something like maybe not quite early normalization, but at least coarse graining.
Coarse graining, yes.
So what's the difference? Why not call it renormalization?
We'll call it renormalization.
Okay.
It's just that renormalization seems to be very, you know, abstract, and a Coase graining transformation is just a linear map between, or in this case, it's a linear map between an original lattice and a Coase graining lattice. Okay, there is no other meaning attached to it. But it turns out that you can talk about renormalization. Yeah, nothing deep. Okay, so we saw that, and then we saw another property. We saw that the matrix product state is such that the entropy of a region L, of a region involving L sites, would scale as a constant, whereas in the mirror, the same entropy would scale as a logarithm of L. Okay? And this observation had to do with connectivity. We look at the tensor network. We look at how many bonds we have to cut to detach this region from the rest of the system, how many bonds in the tensor network we have to cut, and we see that here, it's always two, regardless of the size L. Okay? That explains why we have constant entropy. Whereas in the mirror, we realize that as we, depending on the L, we have to cut more and more indices. So as L increases, we have to cut more and more indices to split the wave function of the tensor network into two pieces. And how many? Well, it turns out that it's on the order of log L. Okay? This, the number of indices that we have to cut, the number of bond indices that we would have to cut, gives us an upper bound on the entropy. And then you go, you do numerical simulations, and you see that indeed this upper bound is saturated. Good. So then summary is we've done one dimension. We found matrix product state with exponential decay of correlations with entropy that saturates the constant. And that was in one-to-one correspondence with properties of ground states of gap systems. And with the mirror, we found polynomial decay of correlations, a logarithmic increase of entropy with the size of the region, and that those properties are in one-to-one correspondence with ground states of critical systems. Good. one dimension. What about two dimensions? Today we want to talk about two dimensions. So in two dimensions, we can generalize these two ansets, these ansets and these other ansets. So what's the natural generalization of a matrix product state? Well, in a matrix product state, what we had was a lattice in one dimension, right? Remember the physical lattice. We had sides, an array of sides in one dimension. And we just build tensors that follow that pattern. So if we want to study a lattice in two dimensions, we could just repeat the trick. Okay? But now we will connect our tensors following the two-dimensional lattice. So if we wanted to represent a wave function, the ground state of a system on a square lattice, we could use a tensor network like this. And this is called projected entangled pair states, PEPs. Okay? So it turns out that maybe our intuition about what properties these ansets would have fails or may fail. Because, well, if it's a generalization of the matrix product state where correlations would decay exponentially, you may think, okay, correlations will decay exponentially here as well. But it turns out that depending on the choice of tensors, the correlations may decay exponentially with the distance, but they could also decay with another choice of tensors. They may also decay polynomially. Okay, so we can choose, make a choice of variational parameters in these ansets such that when we look at two-point correlators, they will decay as a power law as well. So we can, this ansat is compatible with these two behaviors. And when we look at the entropy, we'll see that it reproduces a boundary law. Okay, so let's spend a couple of minutes trying to understand properties of this, and then I'll just mention that we can also, to describe two-dimensional systems, we could also generalize this structure. So we could think of a Cosgrain transformation in two dimensions with these entanglers as well. And it's too hard. It's painful, really painful to draw, so I didn't do it. But the intuition is the same, exactly the same. Build a Cosgrain transformation in two dimensions. Make sure that, remember this causal cone structure where we had the causal cone that the width had to remain constant, so that the computational cost would not increase or would be under control. Well, this is the same there. And what we find is another surprise. Correlations, indeed, as expected, or as in the one-dimensional case, correlations will decay as a power law. And for the same, exactly the same reason as here, that if you look at two points and you look at a path within the tensor network, they are connected through a path that only takes log L steps. But the surprise is here. When we look at the entropy in one dimension was log L, so it was a logarithmic correction to the boundary law. In two dimensions, the entropy is a boundary law. Okay? So we've built some intuition of what these tensor networks are in one dimension and their properties. And when we try to generalize them to two dimensions, we have surprises. In particular, the PEPs, these PEPs could be used to represent ground states of gap systems, but also of critical systems. Surprise. And with the mirror, we see that in one dimension, we were obtaining a logarithmic correction. In two dimensions, we don't obtain a logarithmic correction for the entropy.
But the PEPs points us for this critical or gap system entropy as a L log L?
No, the entropy is always L. That's right. You would not want to use this to represent the ground state of a system in two dimensions with a one-dimensional permissive.
Other critical theory.
Yes. But same thing here. We cannot use the two-dimensional mirror for that. All right, so let's spend a few minutes talking about PEPs. By the way, PEPs was introduced by Frank Perstrate, who is one of the speakers coming in May, and Ignacio Sirac. Well, what we see here is that, as I said, you connect the tensors in a two-dimensional way, as a two-dimensional array. And I want to justify these two properties. We cannot justify them as thoroughly as we did with matrix product states or meta, but the intuitive idea should be there as well. Okay, it can be justified at least at an intuitive level. And so let's start with correlations. Let's see what type of decay of correlations we would have if we describe our system, our ground state, with an ansatz like this. So suppose we have a state that can be described with a PEPS. And now let's look at a two-point correlator. So this is the ket, right? Psi. This is the bra. So you just complex conjugate everything and invert it. And then you insert operators acting on sides x, which this is going to be side x, and side y, which is going to be side y. Okay? So what I represent here is not yet this number. What we have to do now is to take this leg and contract it with this one, and so on, right? We would have to put these two structures together. But I wanted to make it clear that we put these two tensors in the sandwich, these two operators in there. And now, what I want you to imagine is that we really collapse this structure, okay? So we take this index and we multiply it with this one. And so these two tensors become one tensor, and the same pairwise for all the tensors we have. And now we look at it from the top. And if we look at it from the top, we get something like this. Where each of these tensors now represents the product of one tensor with its adjoint, okay? And these two points here represent the product of three tensors. Okay, so it will be this tensor times this tensor all together. Okay, and we look at it from the top. And now this is a tensor network. Okay, and we would like to get an idea or an intuition of how correlations will decay here. And I will just argue that suppose that for some reason correlations are kind of short-ranged. So this is a state that the correlations. So suppose that when we try to look compute this tensor network, imagine that the main contribution to the correlator comes from the straight line. So you see, we would compute this by again multiplying several tensors together, order L tensors together, and as in the one-dimensional case. So what I'm saying is, imagine that the tensors around don't play much of a role in this computation for some reason. Okay, then if we do that, we'll see that again our correlator is the result of applying some matrix L times, right? Multiply, so it will have some matrix to the Lth power. This matrix will be related to these objects here, and automatically, as in the case of a matrix product state, we would obtain an exponential decay of correlations. Dennis? Okay, so that would be one possibility. But it turns out that we could be in another situation where the assumption that these other tensors don't play a role in this calculation was wrong. It could be that when we look at the correlator between these two points, this correlator, that we have a leading contribution that comes from this multiplication with all these tensors. But imagine that for some reason also these tensors contribute. And also these tensors contribute. Maybe less, but they still contribute. It turns out that then you will have many more contributions to this two-point correlator. Okay? In such a way that they can adapt to being a power law. And the intuition here is also that if I have a given distance, right? So I may think that maybe the tensors in, say, a circle that involves these two points would contribute. But now imagine that I have these two points are farther away. Then the circle of tensors that could influence this value is larger, right? So more and more tensors contribute to this correlator. And so there is room. I mean, you know, I have to appeal to your imagination, but you see that this is different from the one-dimensional case where we had just that string of tensors connecting the two points.
Yeah. Is there a way to know a priori which tensors will contribute and which will not?
No, that's a very good question. So we don't know. But actually, this question is related to being able to. So it turns out that we didn't have time to see this, but I originally intended to talk about classical partition functions in two dimensions. And it turns out that, just believe me, if we if we have a classical partition function on a square lattice, say the criticalizing model, classicalizing model into dimensions, we would end up with a tensor network exactly like this.
Uh-huh.
Okay?
Yeah.
And then, being able to, a priori to understand how the two-point correlators are going to decay, that is an interesting question, but it's not obvious at all, right? So you really have, so this is a many-body problem by itself. So here, this looks like a scalar product of, it's coming from a scalar product or a two-point correlator, but this could also correspond to a calculation where we have a classical partition function in two dimensions. And if we just look at one tensor, we don't know what properties the whole tensor network is going to have. So we really need to go and consider the union of all these tensors together. Okay, it's a many-body problem on its own. We cannot just, given a tensor, decide whether this corresponds to a critical case or a gap case. Okay. Yeah.
Just to make sure that what distinguishes these two cases, the first case has a Shell-Rayleigh.
Yes, but if I say that, I could have said directly it has exponential decay of correlations. So I'm just saying that it's very hard to characterize this by just looking at a given tensor. But when you do these calculations, sometimes you end up in that situation and sometimes in this situation. And what I'm saying is that this situation is analogous to what we had in the one-dimensional case. And you can imagine, you could imagine that this is the result of when you do this calculation, that of having only these tensors contribute to this correlator. Then it looks like a one-dimensional system. But in order to understand this correlation, then you could imagine that actually more and more tensors contribute. And this is not the theorem. We don't understand under which conditions this happens. We just see that this could happen, right? It's it's like experimental fun. Good. What about entanglement entropy? So, well, we've learned how to estimate entanglement entropy, right? We just take our wave function and we try to detach the region that we're interested in from the rest. And we look at how many bonds we have to break. Okay, and I think you did this again in the tutorial on Wednesday. The rank of, upper bounds on the rank of reduced density matrices or its mid ranks. So this is what we have here. We have that if we consider a region, so you can imagine that this goes on forever, right? This system, this lattice is infinite. So let's worry only about the region of interest, which I take as being a block of L times L spin. So this region in the middle, okay? And now I ask, how many bonds do I have to break to split this tensor network into two pieces? One that contains all the physical indices for that region and the rest. So it turns out, well, I missed a red line here, but in red you can see all the bonds that you have to break. And obviously, if you this number of bonds grows as the size of the boundary, right? So if you consider a larger region, you'll have to break more bonds. And how many bonds? Well, exactly is proportional to the size of the boundary. So this tensor network is such that automatically the entropy scales at most as a boundary law. And when you try this numerically, you see that indeed saturates the boundary law. Okay? Great, so we have a way of reproducing the boundary law in two dimensions. So let's go back to our table. And in tensor networks for one dimensions, we saw them in detail. Tensor networks in two dimensions, we're just talking about it a little bit, about them a little bit. Let me say that remember, we usually, to decide whether a tensor network is useful, we have properties A, B, and C. Here we are talking about C, how correlations and entropy scale. What about A, property A? Well, this is an efficient representation, right? Because the number of tensors grows proportional to the system size. But can we efficiently compute with it? Okay. So it turns out that if you try to compute the scalar product that we just saw, if you try to do this efficiently, well, if you try to do this exactly, the cost is exponential. Okay? This tensor network cannot be efficiently contracted. However, it turns out that you can efficiently contract it if you introduce some small errors. Okay, so there is so we have there are many techniques where you can that allow you to contract this tensor network efficiently at the price of introducing small errors. Nice. And so this, in one dimension, we had the ability to exactly contract these tensor networks. In two dimensions, if we want to contract this tensor network, we'll have to do it approximately. And I think you'll see this in the homework. You'll have to think about this during the homework. But the important thing is, this is one of the leading tensor networks for two-dimensional systems, in spite of the fact that there is some degree of approximation involved in the computation of expectation values. OK, and then two-dimensional mirror, as I said before. So just think about it. Reproduce this experiment of coarse-graining the lattice, but in two dimensions, and you'll get a new tensor network. It will have two dimensions plus scale, so it will be three-dimensional, which is one of the reasons why I don't dare to try to draw this. But what you see is, remember that we had a table of possible scalings of entanglement entropy. And in two dimensions, as you've been mentioned before, you had the case, what did you, of systems with a one-dimensional Fermi surface. So it turns out that we would, in that case, we'd have L log L, not just L for the entropy. And so what do we do, right? So it turns out that the tensor networks that we have are not enough to cover all the cases that we learn, all the scalings of entropies that we saw the first day. Okay? So then we have to resort to, so this was an open problem for several years. But recently, it was understood how to go beyond the boundary law. And in order to illustrate that, well, this is possible using a variation of the mirror, which is called branching mirror. And this is of interest in two dimensions, but it's too complicated to explain in two dimensions. Nevertheless, the main idea, we can explain it in one dimension. Okay? So what I want to explain to you now is how can we beat the boundary law in two dimensions, but I'm going to use the one-dimensional case, okay? Just to get the main idea, and then we'll think about how this looks in two dimensions. So what we want to do is we want to go beyond the mirror. We want to go beyond the scaling of entropy in the mirror, but while keeping the computational cost under control. That's the motivation. And I don't know if you recognize the mirror here, but this is what we discussed yesterday. It's only that we have this isometries going two legs into one. And here, I just made explicit that this isometries with, say, two legs going into one leg, this is the one leg. But the other, you can complete it if you put an extra leg, but that has state zero acting on it. Remember, every time we have a leg with a given state acting on it, we're fixing the leg, right? It's as if we only had three indices. So then it turns out that this quantum circuit implements the mirror. Okay? And if this is the mirror, then that we saw where we have log n layers, it turns out that we can regard this as a particular case of a more complicated tensor quantum circuit, the branching mirror, which will look like this. So I'm saying that this is a particular case of this, because if I come here and I decide that all these gates are identities, and also all these gates are the identity, and this gate is the identity, then I get exactly the mirror. Okay? But as you can see, we can consider a more complicated situation. OK, so now we should go through our checklist, right? Property A, is this an efficient representation? Can anybody comment on that? How many gates do you see here? On this axis, this is n, the number of sites, right? Order n gates. But, well, yeah, but on this axis, we have log n layers. So this looks like n log n gates, OK? So it's not n, it's n log n, but it's not a big deal. this is still efficient. We need to specify n log n gates, and then we have completely specified the state that results from applying this, all these gates to a product state. Property B, efficient computation. I'm not going to be able to discuss this, okay? But it turns out that this has been designed in such a way that you can still efficiently compute expectation values of local observables. Okay. Property C, scaling of correlations. Actually, we don't know scaling of correlations. This is fairly recent. And one of the things that Dominique is doing as part of her essay is to study decay of correlations in this structure. It's too early to know. Entropy, that's the one that I want to explain. But before I do that, let me indicate that this is the branching mirror, or full capacity branching mirror with all these branches. This is the regular mirror. And now I want you to focus on the branching structure that we have here. So you see, the essence of this quantum circuit is that when you start at the top, let's start here. When we start at the top, we let a part of the system, say these two guys, interact together, and these two guys together. And later, these four guys will interact together. The eight of them will interact together. So it's like a tree where you start from the leaves and you go down and get thicker and thicker branches. Okay, you see the tree structure there. Okay, that's this line here. We could have just draw it here. And having this valley here means that all the way to here, these two parts of the system didn't interact. So then you can see that the normal mirror is just having one branch of that. And between the normal mirror and the fully branched mirror, we can have many things in between. Okay, we could consider this case, for instance, where we have some of the branches there and some of the branches are not there. Okay. So it turns out that you choose your branching pattern, then you look at the scaling of entropy, and you realize that the scaling of entropy depends on the branching pattern. For instance, in one dimension, we already saw this is the regular mirror, just one branch. We saw that the entropy of a block of size L scales as log L. Let's have a look at this branch, this pattern. Well, you try this pattern, and you see that the entropy now scales as log L square. Okay? Do we know of any physical system that has this scaling? Well, we don't. But that's not the point. Right? The point is that we have an ansatz that we can is efficient. So it's an efficient representation of wave functions. We can efficiently compute with it, and such that the entropy scales as log L square. And if you take the fully branched mirror, then suddenly you recover the bulk law. Okay, so this is a one-dimensional system, and the boundary law will be constant. Logarithmic violation will be this scaling, and this is bulk law. No boundary law, but bulk law. Okay, so this sounds kind of interesting, but also intriguing, because we used to think that tensor networks, the power or the reason why we can simulate ground states with tensor networks is because these states are not very entangled. Okay? And that is the case of this idea goes through with matrix product states, we have a boundary law. With PEPs, we have a boundary law instead of a bulk law. With MERA, we have logarithm, right? But suddenly, it turns out that we have a family of tensor networks that represent states where entanglement scales as the bulk law. Okay, so we don't understand this. This is research this is ongoing research. We don't understand where the limit of these representations is. We used to think it was, we can study states which are weakly entangled, but it turns out that the states that we can represent with the fully branched mirror, they are as entangled as they could be. And this is just some examples here with numerical examples done directly with these ansatz.
If you can represent states that are as entangled as they could be with fewer, with like a
not non-exponentially growing bond dimension?
The bond dimension is fixed to chi. And now you grow the system size.
You know, that picture that you drew on the board where you had all these states and, you know, you fix the bond dimension and you grow it, and then you can represent more and more states in the Hilbert space?
Yes.
But here it's like you fix the bond dimension and you can represent all the states in the Hilbert space.
No, not all the states in the Hilbert space. I'm just saying that the property that characterizes the states that I can reproduce is not entanglement anymore. It used to be, you used to think, okay, we have this small manifold of weakly entangled states, and those are the ones, right? We have this huge Hilbert space and this small manifold with weakly entangled states. We used to think that the reason why we can efficiently simulate them is because there is not a lot of entanglement. Now we have an ansatz where entanglement is unrestricted. And of course, this ansatz only depends on n log n parameters, not d to the n, right? So you cannot represent arbitrary states in the Hilbert space. There's still a very strong restriction what states you can represent. But entanglement is no longer the defining feature, the property that would allow you to identify the states that you can simulate and those that you cannot simulate. Okay? So we made progress in research, but our understanding got more confusing, right? Because it's not entanglement. Entanglement is not the key feature that determines whether we can simulate classically or not using tensor networks. Okay?
Usually, the boundary law is obeyed by the ground states, right? Mm-hmm. And the bulk law is something maybe like the non-ground state inside the states.
Right, right.
So I wonder whether this L is still ground state, maybe not.
We don't know. Yes. Ask Dominic. Okay, so let me just give you a very simple intuition, the main idea why the entanglement, the scaling of entanglement entropy changes as you include branches. Okay, and for that, let's just consider a very simple case where we have only two branches. So what this means is we have this coserine transformation that actually, instead of coserine, decouples the system into two pieces. And then after that, we continue with a normal mirror and also with a normal mirror. Okay? Believe it or not, I mean, that this drawing may be a bit confusing, but that's because things get complicated. But what you have to take from here is that if we were to ignore all this part, we will be back to a normal mirror. So if we just had this branch, and remember the causal cone structure we have, if you have an operator acting on three sides here, would go back to an operator acting on three sides here, and so on. We have this causal structure. Now it turns out that if we start with an operator acting on three sides, under transformation, it becomes an operator acting on three sides here and three sides there. So it becomes a six-side operator. Okay? So that's not good for business. The causal cone, the width, is doubled. Okay? But it turns out that because these two parts don't interact with each other until that moment, we can deal with that computationally. So that's not an issue. What I want you to focus on is in the fact that, so that's the wrong picture. But so I have to change this picture. So what I wanted you to see here is that if you have a region of size L, so if you had L spins here, if you try to disconnect the region from the rest of the lattice, as we usually do to find an upper bound to the entanglement entropy, okay, we want to count how many legs we have to break. Now, if we only had one branch here, we would have to break a number of legs that would depend on how high we have to go up here. Okay, but it turns out that when we have two branches, we'll have to go up here and go up here as well. And we'll have to break twice as many legs, bond indices. Okay, so because we have two branches now, it turns out that the connectivity in the tensor network has increased, has doubled. And in this case, this particular case where we only have two branches, we would get that the entanglement entropy of a region of size L scales as log L coming from one branch and log L coming from the other branch. So this is still just log L. Okay? But you got the idea. The idea is that since we have more branches here, there are more contributions to the entanglement entropy. Okay, when we try to detach, to break the tensor network into two pieces, one for our block and one for the rest, we get contributions from each branch. One indices that we have to cut in each branch. Okay? And this is the key. In this particular case, we only have two contributions, but if we had more branches, then we would have more contributions, more and more contributions. And how many contributions would depend on L. Okay? And for instance, one of the cases we discussed, in this particular case, in this case here, the number of local contributions that you would be local. And this is, so you would have local contributions, each one giving you local. And that's why you get local square. Okay. And well, you can see here that you would have so many contributions that when you add them together, gives you L. Good. So summary of the branching mirror. By generalizing the idea of mirror, which would correspond the case of one branch into many branches, we can go all the way from local scaling in one dimension to bulk scaling L. Okay? And what this means is there are many different scalings in between, depending on your choice of branching pattern. Okay? And when you take the same idea, okay, the same idea, so a quantum circuit with branching to two dimensions, or two, three, four dimensions, any number of dimensions larger than one, what you realize is that if you keep just one branch, you get a boundary law. Okay? That's what we had. That's the mirror. Mirror saturates, follows a boundary law for entanglement entropy. But if you consider other patterns, you can go again all the way up to bulk law. And in particular, there is some choice of branching pattern that will give you boundary law times a logarithmic correction. Okay?
Make sure to understand how you, you know, think about using a tensor network. So is it that you have a construction that allows you to capture an entanglement up to a certain bound, and then so you use it then to study systems that have as much as or less than this type of entanglement, or what do you do?
No. So there is so much we can reason here. Okay? So we have an ansatz, a tensor network ansatz. And we don't know a priori whether it's going to be good to represent certain ground states.
Yeah.
But we know that if we cannot match the scaling of entanglement entropy that we observe in the ground state, this ansatz is not going to be good. Okay? So what we do then, so ground states, suppose we have a ground state that we would like to simulate. And we know that this ground state has some properties. If our ansatz is not capable of reproducing these structural properties, forget about using this ansatz. So what we do is we look at ansatz. We try to first, as a first step, try to find many-body wave functions, tensor networks, that would reproduce the properties, the structural properties, say, scaling of entanglement, scaling of correlations that we believe that our ground state has. Okay? So, but this doesn't guarantee that this is going to be a good ansatz. Right? But if we could not match those properties, then right, then that would not be a good ansatz. So a necessary condition for our tensor network to be a good ansatz for a given ground state is that it reproduces the scaling of entropy, the scaling of correlations.
So for a given problem, you sort of have to think about what you expect and then choose the right.
That's right. So suppose that you want to simulate some ground state, say a Fermi liquid, with a one dimension. So in two dimensions with a one dimensional Fermi surface. Then don't get the mirror. Don't use the mirror because it cannot match the scaling of entanglement entropy. Right? There are logarithmic violations in this ground state, of a logarithmic violation of the boundary law. Don't get a tensor network that cannot match that. Mm-hmm. So in this case, we would try and use the branching mirror. Now, do we know that that's going to be a good ansatz? We don't know. We know that it fulfills the right properties of scaling as far as entanglement is concerned. Okay.
Sorry, can I ask one more? But to me, it seems like if a particular construction tends to give you a particular answer, like a branching mirror tends to give you a bulk entanglement scaling, then how do you know that it's not working if the construction itself tends to lead, or does it tends to?
So these were properties. We in this week we didn't talk at all about variational parameters, how to optimize them, right? So this is we have not started the serious work. We have just looked at the general structure of the ansatz. So in order to finally see whether this is a good ansatz or not for the ground state of a particular system, you just have to take the Hamiltonian and take this ansatz, look at the expectation value for a random choice of parameters. So you choose your parameters in the ansatz randomly. You compute the expectation value of the Hamiltonian. This Hamiltonian is a sum of local terms, right? And we know how to compute efficiently the expectation value of a local term. So we can efficiently compute the expectation value of the Hamiltonian for a random choice of variational parameters. And then we get some number. This is the energy that we have for this choice of variational parameters. And now we can ask, OK, what if I change this variational parameter in this direction? Does the energy go up or down? Well, I can compute it, right? So I can make a change in variational parameters, look at the new energy, and decide whether that was a good change or not. And in this way, I can try to lower the energy. Okay? And so that would be the variational part, the optimization, variational optimization of the ansatz. And only then you will see whether this was a good approximation to the ground state or not. Okay? But this part, there isn't a lot of a structure that can be discussed about that. It's just get the computer, program the whole thing, run simulations, and see if you're lucky. However, tensor networks come with, these are not just a numerical approach. They come with an increase of, so we, by thinking about tensor networks, we've learned about the general structure of correlations and entanglement in ground states. Because this is the part I'm not telling you, but you can take these ansatz now, use it to simulate quantum systems, ground states of quantum systems, and they work very well. Okay? So we know that this structure, the way we have connected the tensors, is the right way to represent that wave function. But this doesn't follow from the discussion we had here. OK. So time to summarize. What did we see the first week? Well, the first week, we talked about entanglement and a bipartite system. We talked about being able to distinguish a product state from an entangled state. We saw the Schmidt decomposition for a bipartite system. And then suddenly we jumped and we started talking about systems with many, many parts. So systems, lattice systems with many, many sides. And we looked at properties of ground states on those systems. And this is a summary of the table. This comes from fermions, studying free fermions. And remember, we had one dimension, two dimensions. You had some homework to do with two dimensions. And the general results, so the result generalizes to three, an arbitrary number of dimensions. And what we find there is that if we have a gap system, in any dimension, we have a boundary law for entanglement entropy. If we have a gapless system with a small Fermi surface, so the Fermi surface is smaller than d minus one dimensional, then we still have a boundary law. And if we have Fermi surface of dimension d minus one, we have logarithmic corrections to that. Okay, that was the first week. That's a summary of what we saw. We learned that ground states of in the dimensions of local Hamiltonians, of physical Hamiltonians, they obey a very particular law of a scaling for entanglement entropy. And then what did we see the second week? The second week, we talked about tensor networks. And what we wanted is roughly to find a way of reproducing all these scalings using tensor networks. And so during the week, we saw a matrix product state. And the matrix product state was, so if we study one dimension, the matrix product state is the one that saturates, reproduces the saturation of the entropy. Then we saw the MERA. The MERA was the ansatz that could reproduce the logarithmic violation of the boundary law in one dimension. And then today, I've talked a little bit about PEPS and MERA. And what we see is that we can use this tensor network, in principle, as far as the scaling of entanglement is concerned, we would think that they might be good ansatz for ground states, for gap systems, and also for gapless systems with a small Fermi surface. And finally, we've said a couple of things about how to generalize the MERA so that we can also cover the logarithmic violation of entanglement entropy. Okay, so this table would summarize the 2 weeks the width of the course. So I want to finish by telling you about things that are going on in the field. So the main motivation, the starting point for tensor networks, the main motivation why we started thinking about tensor networks was as a way of finding a non-perturbative numerical approach to solve problems in two dimensions. Okay? For instance, I don't know if you know about Monte Carlo, quantum Monte Carlo is a generic approach for quantum many-body systems. It turns out that when you try to solve use quantum Monte Carlo for systems of frustrated antiferromagnets, that these are spin systems with frustration, or when you try to use Monte Carlo, quantum Monte Carlo for interacting fermions, so in two dimensions again, you have the Haber model, so models of interacting fermions in two dimensions, it turns out that Monte Carlo fails. Quantum Monte Carlo has what's called a sign problem. We cannot use that technique. Okay? Well, we needed some alternative to that. And so tensor networks, in part, were developed as an alternative to quantum Monte Carlo. And one of the main applications nowadays is for frustrated antiferromagnets and interacting fermions. And Philippe Corboth, one of the speakers at the conference in May, will talk about this. He's the leading expert on simulating interacting fermions using PEPs, actually. Okay. Other things that we can do with at the numerical level is study topologically ordered phases. This is something that Shougang, so topological order is something that Shougang will tell you about next week. And Ukesh Shinshio will give his talk next week as well in the first conference, the Four Corner Conference, about how to use tensor networks to simulate topologically ordered phases. Another thing that you can do is to use the mirror to study quantum critical systems. Okay, so this is all numerical work. So if you don't like numerics, you know, it's like that type of stuff. But it turns out that this was the original motivation for tensor networks, but since then we have learned that they are useful also, not just in a numerical context. And an example of what has been possible in recent years is to issue a classification of symmetry protected gap phases. So I don't have time to explain this, but basically we can use matrix product states to represent all gap phases in one dimension. Okay. And thanks to that, now we can study what different phases we could have by just studying what different tensors we could have. Okay. So we've reduced the problem of talking about vectors in a very large Hilbert space to the problem of analyzing properties of tensors. And that has allowed for a complete classification of symmetry-protected gap phases in one dimension, thanks to matrix product states. And there is ongoing progress, so there is a proposal for a partial classification in higher dimensions. And this is work in progress. And most of this, or an important part of this effort, is happening here at perimeter. Shougang Wen is involved in the first classification and also the second one. Yeah. And then something strange happened. So it was, we were talking about lattice models, okay? But suddenly, well, at some point it became clear that these tensor networks that we have to represent ground states for lattice models, well, if you have a field theory, and you put it on the lattice, you get a lattice model, right? And so we realized that we could start talking about quantum field theory. We could start talking about conformal field theory. And it got a bit weird because suddenly string theories were interested in this thing. And nowadays, there is some effort in trying to understand the mirror as a lattice representation of the holographic principle of ABS-CFT. Those of you who are suffering Pedro every morning, this is recorded. Sorry, Pedro. So you probably know a lot about ABS-CFT by now. Okay? So it turns out that these are abstract ideas, but we can realize them on a lattice now. And since, surprisingly, have 5 more minutes, I've prepared some more material to talk about this. So what I want to tell you is just to give you a 5-minute idea of what we can do about conformal field theories and the holographic principle. Okay? So this is lecture is over. It's not, but But this is bonus material, okay? Just to give you an idea of what's happening nowadays with the research. So remember that we talked about the mirror as a Coriolanian transformation, or a building block of the mirror as a Coriolanian transformation. And we discussed that if we had an operator acting on three sides, it was mapped into an operator acting on three sides. Okay? And now this is a linear map. So you give me an operator, you get an operator here through a linear map. So once you have a linear map, you can ask, okay, what are the eigenvectors of this linear map? Okay? And in this case, an eigenvector of this linear map would be an operator that when coarse grain is mapped into itself, okay, times an eigenvalue that I write as 2 to the minus delta. Okay. So it turns out that by playing this trick, once we have this meta, this optimized meta, say for the ground state of a critical Hamiltonian in one dimension, when we look at this linear map, we can identify what we call scaling operators. Operators in the theory that are mapped into themselves under Coriolanian. Okay? So these are operators that you look at it from close, it has some expression, you Coriolan it, you look at it from far away, it's again the same guy, times a constant. Okay, so we have a way to identify the scaling operators, a way of identifying the scaling dimension by just looking at the delta here. Okay, so from the eigenvalue, from the eigenvectors of this linear map, we get the scaling operators. From the eigenvalues, we get the scaling dimensions. And it turns out that with this and these scaling dimensions tell you about the critical exponents of the phase transition and so on. And so let's be more concrete. Just as an example, let's consider a quantumizing model in one dimension. So this is transversizing model, quantum spin chain in one dimension at critical transverse magnetic field, right? So phase transition, where we are at the quantum phase transition. And if we look at this critical theory, there is a conformal field theory describing the long distance behavior. So conformal field theory, you connect directly to Pedro Vieira and fixed points of the RG flow, and so on. So it turns out that in this particular case, we have the so-called, there are scaling operators in this theory. There are infinitely many, but all of them can be organized in three so-called conformal towers. What that means is we need to identify three primary fields that are called identity, spin, and energy density. If you have these three, you know the rest of the scaling dimensions and properties of the theory. Okay? It's part of the structure of a conformal field theory. There is the Virasoro algebra. There are many constraints in the theory. And what you have to do then is to, if you identify these three guys, if you find their scaling dimensions, which we know are 0, 1 over 8, and 1, then you have identified, you know about all the rest of the scaling dimensions. They are these numbers plus an integer. So this is for the quantumizing model, and this is what we find numerically. Okay, so we have these three scaling operators, primary fields, identity, spin, and energy. And now, if we look at remember this linear map that changes scale from one lattice to another? We said, let's look at the eigenvalues, and we'll find the scaling dimensions. I plot them here. So the scaling dimensions, we find one that is 0, one that is 1/8, one that is 1, exactly as expected for the identity, spin, and energy density. And then we find all other scaling dimensions, which are 0 plus 2, or 1/8 plus 1, 1/8 plus 2, or 1 plus 1, etc. So we find all the spectrum of this linear map is organized in conformal towers, as expected from conformal field theory.
And what about two-dimensional quantumizing model? Do you have the results for the exponents?
Yes, with precision of one digit. So yeah, it doesn't work very well. I mean, this is work in progress. Mm-hmm. Glenn Evenly, who is another speaker at the conference in May, he's the leading person in two-dimensional mirror. And he's been able to improve a lot on those results. I think he's getting 2 or 3 digits now. But yeah, going to 2+1 dimensions with mirror is very demanding. But there should be some new results on that soon. Anyway, this is the prediction from conformal field theory. And these are the numerical results that we get, okay? Just by diagonalizing this linear map. And so you can see that you can get precisions which are several digits of accuracy. Now we're talking about the critical theory. These are hard to simulate in principle. But just because we got the right ansatz, okay, an ansatz that would, in a natural way, give polynomial decay of correlations, we can focus on getting high precision results. And this is just a comment to the, for the experts. These are the three primary fields which are local. There are also non-local primary fields called the disorder operator and fermionic operators, and we can also extract them from the meta, and again get similar precisions. Okay, so it turns out that this conformal field theory is completely characterized by the conformal data. So what that means is, you give me this set of data, so-called conformal data. The fact that this is a conformal field theory implies that there are many symmetries, and just with this conformal data, you have completely characterized the conformal field theory. Okay? So it turns out that from the meta, we can get all this conformal data. Okay? We can extract all this, and this is part of the conformal data. It's called operator product expansion coefficients, OPE, and these are numerical estimates with precision. So this will be the exact solution, and we get them up to corrections of 10 to the minus 6 times 10 to the minus 4. So 3 digits of accuracy again. And from there, we can derive the fusion rules. The important thing is that all these are properties of a conformal field theory. Okay, this is a conformal field theory. We're working on the lattice. We never leave the lattice. We constrain the lattice into another lattice and so on. We are working on the lattice. But we are reproducing to very high precision properties of a field theory, of a conformal field theory. Okay, so this is what I mean by we have a non-perturbative approach to conformal field theories. Because this was the Ising model, this is piece of cake. I mean, we have an exact solution. But there are many conformal field theories that are not so simple. And now we have an approach to go and try to find their properties, the conformal data. Okay, this was an illustration then that we can use the meta to study quantum field theories, and in particular conformal field theories. And then I also mentioned holography. So it turns out that, and this is just very flashy, but we can think of this as a realization of the holographic principle. So the mirrors can be understood or interpreted as a lattice realization of the holographic principle. The first step that we have to do is we just look at this tensor network, right, where this index is connected with that one, so there are periodic boundary conditions here. We can just look at it where this guy becomes thin. Okay, so these two tensor networks are exactly the same. Okay, I just took all the open legs and throw them around a circle. It's the same thing. Okay, but now when you see this tensor network, you start thinking, oh, does this look like hyperbolic geometry at some level? And so for those of you who have been seeing stuff about ADS-CFT, I want you just to have a look at this and think, okay, so what's the simplest case? So suppose you have we just argued that the meta gives you a good approximation to a conformal field theory, okay? So the conformal field theory in this case would be 1 plus 1, where 1 is a space, the other is time. Time in a ground state doesn't exist, so we are left with one dimension. So you could think of, so time is frozen, or nothing depends on time. And what we have to think is that we have a conformal field theory living in this lower circle, okay? And that the meta is giving us a representation of the ground state of this conformal field theory. So as a tensor network, the meta describes the state of a boundary, of the boundary of this geometry, okay? But now you could think, you look at the tensor network again, and you say, well, but this is a two-dimensional object now. And this direction is precisely scale, okay? Moving in this direction towards the center is changing the scale in your system. But that's exactly what's happening with anti-de Sitter space. So it turns out that if you look at this, if you look at the, now you could ask about distance between points, and you would see that the structure of geodesics is the same. It's a lattice version of what you would find in anti-de Sitter. And so on. You realize that there are many properties of this tensor network that mimic what you would have in anti-de Sitter space. Okay? So this is a comment for those of you who are familiar or know something about ADS-CFT. The idea is that nowadays several people are looking at the meta as a lattice realization of the holographic principle. Okay? And now it's later than, well, finally managed to be too late. So that will conclude. Thanks.